So this is an example of how sexual technology extends the body. It's also an example of how, like I said, you have these black swan moments where who would have thought you would put cameras together with telephones in the 1950s. So now let's switch gears to some contemporary developments and talk about some current technologies and where they might be headed. One of the current technologies, which again, I think folks have been talking about a lot here yesterday, is lifestyle pharmaceuticals. Now, you could claim that lifestyle pharmaceuticals begin with things like opium or marijuana or alcohol, which makes them thousands of years old. I would say that lifestyle pharmaceuticals, as I am referring to them, which is basically drugs that don't really cure anything, they just make you feel better in some way. Like either they make you feel better because you can fuck without using birth control, they make you feel better because you're a little less depressed, they make you feel better because you can get an erection like whenever you want, which is awesome. And so that's why I would say that something like maybe Valium or the pill is kind of the first lifestyle pharmaceutical, which is really popularized in the 1960s. Here we have the yellow pills, our favorite Valium over here. And over here, the blue pills that I have are Viagra, which is the contemporary world's most famous and most popular lifestyle drug. Pfizer has made billions of dollars on it. So the question is, we've got these pills. We can use them for fucking. So how are they going to evolve in the future? So the question is, what do our historical stories that we've been hearing about tell us about how technology is likely to evolve? Well, one way is that it will converge with another kind of technology. My guess, particularly because there is a strong push to market a female Viagra, is that we're going to get some kind of combination of a purely sex-based pill like Viagra, something that just causes a pure physiological reaction, combined with some kind of mood-altering pill to give you sex mood pills. And part of the reason I say this is because I've done quite a bit of research on what current scientists are trying to do to invent a female Viagra. And a couple of years ago, I published an article in Wired about scientists at the University of Washington and at Rutgers who were doing experiments where they put women into MRI machines, magnetic resonance imaging machines, and watched what was happening in their brains while they were having orgasms. Now, the reason why they did that wasn't just because it's awfully hot to imagine a girl like in a giant magnet having an orgasm, but also because tests of Viagra on women revealed something very interesting, which is that it actually has the same physiological effect on women that it does on men, which is to say it causes the erectile tissues around the vagina to become engorged. It actually can cause lubrication, but only very rarely when the women taking the Viagra, when they were asked if they felt horny, only very rarely would they say that they did, even though their body was giving the kind of physiological signals of arousal. Women were like, nope, sorry, not feeling anything. And this was sort of looked at scientifically, and then people like Susie Bright wrote about it and said, yeah, it was kind of okay, but it didn't really work that well. So the current theory right now, and Pfizer is pumping a lot of money into researchers who are looking at it, is that in order to get women to feel horny, we basically have to hit their brains. We basically have to figure out what's happening in their brains when they're turned on and when they're having orgasms in order to develop some kind of pharmaceutical that makes them feel horny in their brains. There have been, as I said, a number of studies. Barry Komisaruk, who is working at Rutgers, has just published a great book called The Science of Orgasm, which I urge you all to check out, which is about his experiments with the MRI machine. And he's also working with Beverly Whipple, who's a longtime proponent of female masturbation. so that's great. So basically what we're going to see is, I think, drugs which are some combination of a mood-altering drug, which we already have, and some kind of sexual trigger drug. But then, let's go a little further into the future. It's not very hard to predict that we're going to have female Viagra. I mean, duh, we all want it. Well, all the women want it. And I'm sure the boys will like it too once we're all coming all over the place. But then the question is, what could we think of that a pharmaceutical could do that would produce the kind of novel physical situations, the novel sexual situations that the vibrator produced? Remember, the vibrator created a sexual sensation that really hadn't existed before. It also speeded up the process of female orgasm, if you've ever noticed. Oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, the vibrator is a kind of labor-saving device, shall we say. It speeds things up. So what if we had some kind of pharmaceutical that speeded things up in the same way, gave you the same old orgasms, just like vibrators do, same old orgasms, but through a different mechanism of action, it could create those orgasms just by you taking a pill or sniffing something or putting a patch on, or hopefully not injecting something because that's gross, but whatever, it could be injecting something, and you could be reliably certain that you would have an orgasm within 10 minutes after ingesting this drug. Well, this creates a whole new way of imagining how sex could happen. For example, you could be in your electrical engineering class playing with this, take a pill, and have an orgasm while soldering something on your motherboard. You could have an orgasm while doing math problems. You could have an orgasm in a restaurant without having to worry about those weird wireless vibrator things that Good Vibes is always saying, perfect for restaurants. it's really not, actually. Tried it. I'd rather have the drug. And the thing that I think is so interesting about this, and this isn't just about my sexual fantasies about having orgasms while rebuilding my hard drive, is that it would allow people to eroticize things on purpose that might be kind of physically difficult to eroticize otherwise. So for example, you may be one of these people who's really turned on by watching people get pies in the face. It's not always easy to time your orgasm to perfectly coincide with watching a pie fight or even to coincide with throwing a pie. Even though it gets you really turned on, you might have to throw the pie and then kind of run to the bathroom, like jack off really fast, and then come back. That gets a little annoying after a while. So I think that something like this orgasm pill or orgasm drug would allow people to more fully embody and fully live out those fetish fantasies of having an orgasm while throwing a pie. Like, I get to come right as it hits her face. So I think that that's something to think about for the future. And I do think that, and I'll talk about this in just a second, there's good reason to believe that we're not that far away from the instant orgasm that you just order up, you know, while you're soldering something. So the next and sort of final story I want to tell you about the future of sexual technology is about biosensors. And luckily, actually, Kyle talked about this a little bit yesterday, the kinds of stuff that's happening now with biosensors and the way we can use biosensors. There's several different kinds of biosensors out there now. Many of them have been in use for decades. There's galvanic skin response, which measures the electrical intent, the sort of electrical charge in your skin. There's electrocardiograms, which measure heart rate. Electroencephalograms, which measure electricity as it's traveling in your head. So that's that little hood that I showed you earlier with all of the wires coming out of it. And also, Kyle showed us yesterday, somebody had designed a game controller that's basically an EEG that picks up electrical signals from your head and can theoretically move things around on screen. There's also magnetic resonance imaging. What's great about MRI is that it measures blood flow to an area, which is basically when your brain is thinking about something, not only does electrical activity in that area of the brain increase, but also blood flow increases in order to fuel that electrical energy. So if you put an EEG and an MRI together, you have a great map of the electrical and blood levels in various parts of your brain. And then also, coming around the bend, we have implantable wireless biosensors. Those are basically just microchips with antennae on them that you implant into your body, and they're being used right now. They're being developed for soldiers who are in the field to monitor things like heart rate, to monitor whether they've been injured or wounded and they need help. And so these biosensors can be monitoring all of the things like GSR, EKG, EEG would, but then communicating them wirelessly with a network. I have an RFID implanted in my arm that works kind of like that, although it doesn't really do anything. It doesn't pick up my heart rate, and it doesn't give me an orgasm or anything. So it kind of sucks. So what these kinds of biosensors mean, which all exist now, is that, let's not go there yet, is that we can start to think about our bodies as being devices on a computer network. And we can start to think of our sexual feelings, the actual physical manifestations of our sexual feelings, like heart rate increasing, flush increasing, lubrication increasing in certain parts of our bodies, blood flow going to certain parts of the brain that are being mapped by those great guys over at Rutgers right now. So all of those signals that our body is sending out can be looked at as inputs into a computer network through these biosensors. These biosensors can be talking to your computer network and giving all that data to just either your computer or to someone on the other end of it. One of the interesting biosensors that I'm very sad to have seen go away, because it kind of existed before I could take advantage of it, is this orgasm biosensor. It's made by this guy, John Perry, who worked a lot on the G-spot back in the day when we were discovering the G-spot in the 1970s. He invented this thing that is called the insertable EMG sensor. And it's a combination of, I love these words, photoplethysmograph, which is something that reads blood flow through light, and the electromyograph, which is basically just a pressure sensor. So you can see up here on top, John Perry and his buddies were very interested in measuring female orgasms, measuring what exactly was happening in someone's vagina when they were having an orgasm. So this device looks like a dildo, works like a dildo. Stick it on in. It's translucent, so you can project light out of it, and that allows you to read blood flow, so you can see what the pattern is of how engorged the vagina is. And it also has these electromyograph pressure sensors, so you can look for the characteristic muscle contractions that happen during certain stages of the arousal cycle. And as Masters and Johnson showed, actually the muscle contractions that women have during orgasm are fairly easy to predict. The seconds or the half seconds between them always come at a certain time, and so you can recognize the signature of an orgasm through these kinds of pressure sensors. So the reason why I bring this up, and then later you can see below, Verimed, this company, actually tried to sell these commercially, actually for treating incontinent patients to find out how strong their pelvic muscles were. Didn't do very well. Can't buy them anymore. It didn't work out as an application. But the reason why I bring these up is because they're the perfect example of how you could have a biosensor that would read your body's sexual signals and turn them into input. Right now, you also can find, if you Google on patents, because Google can now troll patents for you, which is awesome, that there is an entire patent class which is called stimulating reproductive orgasm. That means there is an entire set of patents devoted entirely to basically devices that will stimulate your sexual organs, your reproductive organ, excuse me. And one of those patents was given to a guy named Stuart Malloy, who you may have heard about. He patented what he calls the orgasmic dysfunction device, which the rest of us just called the orgasm button. He's a pain specialist, and he was operating on a woman about 8 years ago now. And one of the things that he was doing was she was awake, or you know, semi-awake, while he was operating on her spine, and he was stimulating different nerves in her spine to figure out which one was causing her pain. He hit upon a nerve that gave her an orgasm. Reportedly, what happened was, she said, when he hit it, she said, oh, I wish you could teach my husband to do that. So what he did was he figured out that he'd actually found this nerve in the spine that triggers instant orgasm in women, and he decided there'd be this big market for devices that would, here you can see in French, if you read French, an example of how the device would work. Basically, there would be some kind of electrical stimulator that would be plugged into the nerves of your spine. Apparently, you can just have an outpatient local anesthetic procedure to get this done. I have a friend who really wants to do it. He keeps trying to talk me into it, but I don't know if I want to stick anything in my spine and have Stuart Malloy control it is the problem. So you'd have a wireless controller, which you can see over here, which would communicate with the implant and give you the orgasm. It was interesting, Malloy got very negative reception when he presented this at sex conferences or, you know, sort of sexology conferences, because he wanted to build in limits to the device so that you could only use it like once a day. And people, you know, in the sort of sexology profession were like, what the fuck, you know? Like, you want to tell me I can only have one orgasm a day? So there's been some problems with implementation. He's had a really hard time getting people to try the device out. But the device exists, it's been patented, and so this is an example of how, for example, you can have very interesting biosensors and inputs into your body. What I want to leave you with is sort of a snapshot of where this stuff could go in the future, where our orgasm button could go, or where these biosensors could take us. Yeah, I had to have the... people are giggling because they've gotten to the final point on my checklist here. So if you think of biosensors on your body as translating your sexual signals, your sort of sexual physical manifestations of your horniness into something that can be read by a computer, into something that can be sent over a computer network to someone else on the other end, you can also think of that computer network as a transducer. It can take your sexual signals and turn them into something else. Like, you could have that insertable EMG sensor that John Perry so bravely made back in 1975. You could have that in your pussy, and it could be figuring out, oh, Annalie's having an orgasm right now. I'll just send a text message to her boyfriend saying, hi, I just came. That would be a very basic way to transduce a sexual signal. And in fact, I mean, this is the kind of thing that, well, many of us do all the time. I mean, you know, it's late afternoon, jack off, felt really good, text message your lover and say, woo, I was just doing something dirty. I'm sure none of you have ever done that, but I do it on a pretty regular basis. And so it would be nice to have my computer just recognize when I'd had an orgasm and automatically send the message for me. Maybe it could actually send it to all three of my partners. So that would be really great.
Would you have like an RSS feed?
An RSS feed. See, already we're coming up with great ideas. It's Annalie's orgasm RSS. But then there'd be like contests, and it would get, there'd be pressure, and like people would subscribe to the people who had like the most, you know, the best orgasms. And anyway, it would all be Web 2.0.
What about you on Twitter?
Twitter. Well, we've already got Kyle's Twitter application. So the other thing that, as I sort of suggest up here in my list of things that could happen, is you could also have something like a visualization program that responds to your arousal cycle. So you could have sensors that were picking up on the fact that your heart was beating faster, and on the other end, somebody who's tuned into your orgasm RSS feed could be getting a visualization that would show like a beating, throbbing red as your heart raced, and when you came, there would be some kind of like 2001 special effect. The other thing, as we get closer to having haptic devices or force feedback devices that actually function in a way that's a little bit better than your controller shaking when you get shot during a game, a haptic device is just something that interacts with you physically, basically, with like through movement. And so right now there's haptic devices that can imitate a handshake. So I can like handshake something on one end of the country, and on the other end there's a device that has a hand that can shake someone else's hand. Well, you can imagine how this would work with sort of transducing sexual signals. I could have one of those insertable EMG sensors in my pussy, and somebody on the other end could have, I don't know, something else plugged into some other hole. And that could be responding in terms of timing or size to what I'm experiencing at that moment. So as I get more excited, maybe it'll thrust more. Or you could think a little bit more outside the box. I hate to use that term because it, yeah. Anyway, but this is an example of thinking outside the box in both senses of the word. So you could have something where as I'm getting more aroused, on the other end, there's some kind of device like a blood pressure cuff, which gets tighter and tighter and tighter around the person who's watching my sex feed. And as I get more excited, they get more tied up with their blood pressure cuff. Anyway, enough about my fantasies. So finally, where this leads, and the reason why I have this line here on screen that says, have sex as an octopus, is because everybody always says, but what about Second Life? How could this fit in with Second Life? Well, the answer is, if you do have all of these biosensors functioning, you can actually, in some sense, use your avatar, like say you're an octopus in Second Life, or a dragon, actually. Dragons are great. They actually have a lot of them in Second Life. I don't know if they have sex. Maybe Kyle can enlighten us.
Yes.
Thank you. So say you're a dragon in Second Life and you want to have sex as a dragon. Well, how do you convey to the dragon on the other end of the connection that you're getting aroused? I mean, what does it feel like when a dragon gets aroused? Well, maybe you have some kind of device that gets pointy. And the more lubricated I get on my end because I'm having like hot dragon sex, the more like pointy and fiery it gets on the other end. And so you actually feel my dragon orgasm as I'm having my human orgasm. So finally, what I'm basically suggesting here is that what biosensors promise is in some sense the old promise of teledildonics, which is the chance to change the physical interface of sex. Not so much to have sex in another body, but to change the way that my physical being interacts with your physical being while we are stimulating ourselves to orgasm or to whatever state we're hoping to reach. So the reason why I kind of conclude here with this great picture of an erotic MRI machine, I love this image. It makes me think of Grey's Anatomy, and it's like Grey is there with Christina, and she's saying, Christina, get into the machine. None of you watch Grey's Anatomy, but you should, and then you should have this image in your mind. Because, of course, an MRI machine, as it becomes something like, I don't know, a consumer electronics device, as opposed to something that's only affordable by hospitals, it could be something we could use to map our orgasmic brain neurology onto some kind of network that then conveys that information to someone else and stimulates them accordingly. So the MRI could actually become a sex toy to the extent that we gather enough data to understand exactly what a brain looks like when it's aroused. And right now we're not quite there yet, which is why we need more data. What I want to leave you with is the thought that biosensors, which can extend the body, drugs, which can change sensations in the body, all of these bring us back to this dream, as I said, the dream of changing the physical interface of sex, the dream of extending our bodies beyond ourselves, but also the dream that we can change our bodies' outputs, our sexualities, in whatever way we want to. We can use technology to change the way your body reads my body, and we're going to do it, and we're going to use whatever tools are necessary to do it, because that's what sexual technology is about, is changing our sexual signals, changing the way we have sex with each other, and doing it with funny hats. All right, thank you very much.
Okay. I guess two or three questions are here, and I'm like, Kyle, please.
Okay, so both you and I actually in our talks have covered sort of the what I call the you and the me. So like me being your orgasm pill where it's like, okay, I can take the pill and in 10 minutes or something, I know I'm going to come to whatever I want. And the you being I can put something on myself and transmit biometric information so you can kind of see what's going on. But really,
Or
feel it, yeah. But there's still sort of the uncovered or at least not very well covered idea of the us. Technologies that require two or more people. At SIGGRAPH this year, there was actually a controller presented called the Frectric controller, F-R-E-Q-T-R-I-Q. What it is it's a controller that requires human bodies to complete one of the button pushes. So one person will be holding one controller, one person will be holding the other controller, and to actually push one of the buttons in the game, you have to touch the other person in some way. So I was wondering if you could sort of speak to what technologies you might see coming out in the future that require people to actually come together and still require multiple groups of people instead of all of us going off into our offices and coming to pies in the face with our pills.
Well, what you're describing is really interesting, Kyle, because the impression that I'm getting is you're almost talking about a kind of erotic twister game where we all have to be kind of touching each other to make any kind of, to affect whatever's happening on the network or to communicate over the network. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, that's kind of like an orgy scenario where you have technologies that require multiple bodies to activate them or to make them function. But what I want to emphasize, and I probably didn't emphasize this enough, is that almost all of the technologies that I was describing and looking to the future, I intended as at least two-person technologies. And so, for example, these biosensors, it's not about me just feeding my orgasm into the network and, like, you know, Rich subscribes to my RSS feed. Thanks, Rich. But it would be that I would be having sex with my girlfriend. She'd be in Boston. You know, sometimes she's in Boston, but I still want to fuck her. And so she would have a device. I would have a device. We'd both have biosensors that would read our bodily responses. And so this would be a way. That's why I say this is about extending the body, because it's not about becoming like the lonely person with her drugs and her octopus porn, but actually sharing my drugs and my octopus porn with somebody else on the other end. And it might be a trusted loved one. A lot of people don't really want to have sex with strangers, or it might be a stranger who's like, hell yeah, octopus porn, let's get it on. And, you know, they're going to be interacting with me across a great distance in the same way that phone sex is not always a lonely activity, but it's like me talking to somebody on the other end of the phone. So I think that part of what these technologies will do is allow us to redefine what it means to be together with someone sexually. That's part of what it means to redefine the physical interface of sex, is that you may not have to be in the same room with someone to be intimate with them, but that doesn't mean you're not being intimate with them. You are. It's just mediated through a new physical interface.
One thing that really interests me, as you're talking about, for example, the implants, you mentioned you have an RFID implant, of course, a wireless implant, you know. Traditionally, you see a lot of sex toys that are sold, you know, for novelty purposes, only to try and slide under the radar. But as we start getting more in the area of, like, functional MRI and stuff like this, it's going to be a little more difficult to make that argument. And, of course, right now, people who are seeking transsexual operations or who are into body modification, once you get to a certain point, it can be difficult to find somebody to help you out with that. And it seems to me that that will be inhibitory towards achieving this wondrous future that you're speaking of. And I'm wondering if we're going to see an increase of the sort of medical underground, or if there's some way that we're going to integrate this with the accepted medical practice. What do you think about that?
That's a really good question. I think that you're right that it's different to sell a home MRI than it is to sell, like, you know, a novelty sex toy. However, I think that what we're going to see over the next 20 years is, just as we now have a consumer electronics market for communications technologies, computers, stereos, we're going to have a consumer electronics market for medical gadgets. And that you will have home MRIs that are sold for health reasons. They can be sold for biofeedback. They can be sold so that you can achieve serenity. You learn how to, you know, make your brain serene by looking at the images of your brain on the MRI. And that people will buy them for that reason, and that basically sexual uses of them will partly be underground, partly be camouflage technology, like the old vibrators were sold for health and vigor, and these MRI devices will have applications, probably in software, that will be not necessarily what they're sold for, but if you have an MRI... Let's pretend that USB exists in 20 years. Say you have an MRI on that's a USB device that attaches to your computer, and you have drivers and blah blah blah. And so you write some kind of sexual brain interface software that runs on top of that. And so then you have your MRI that's being used as a kind of biosensor for a sexual exchange of information, as opposed to, say, the way it's actually being sold, which is plug this MRI into your computer and get instant information about how relaxed you are, which is going to be like Web 3.0, you know, plug your MRI in and get instant real-time data on what your brain is doing. I don't know about you, but I can see that happening quite easily. So that's what I think is going to happen, is that we first need to get a kind of consumer electronics market for these biotechnological devices and for medical devices, and that will happen. People will want it, and that then we'll have ways of using that for sexual communication.
I don't want to come off sounding like I'm anti-pleasure or anything, because I'm certainly pro-pleasure, but I'm prone to a pretty pessimistic view about the consumer culture manipulating the interface of our sexuality, because basically the predatory capitalist system is going to make us have to rent orgasms in the end and pay for them. So, and it's also what you were saying about speeding up the interface process. Made me think of a Paul Virilio book that I read, Time Bomb, and he kind of repeats himself in this book with other theories that he's already established. But there's kind of a proportional thing to speeding up our culture to catastrophe, to the size and potential of catastrophe. And so I was just wondering, I don't know if I can formulate a question out of that, but looking at sort of the negative impacts of the manipulating the interface to sexuality.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I thought it was great that Mark Derry started us off yesterday by warning us about how all of this stuff is being commodified and reified and framed, contained, and neutralized. So what I worry about is not so much the speeding up, because, like, you can never really come fast enough. I mean, if you want to come fast, I'm not worried about that. That would be nice. But what I am worried about is how this stuff will be commodified and what will happen when you're getting software packages that are about, you know, that create an interface between your bodily state and someone else's bodily state. Or if you're getting something like Stuart Malloy's device, the orgasm button, we can already see how that was going to be regulated, as he was going to only let you have one orgasm a day. So obviously there's going to be the alpha sex geeks who will hack my orgasm device and let me have as many orgasms a day as I want. But I think for ordinary consumers, yeah, there is a danger that the more and more that this stuff gets commodified, the more control corporations will have over how you experience pleasure. I mean, there'll be more freedom because there'll be more ways to communicate, but yeah, I can definitely see problems with that.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on that last question, and I'm trying to think of exactly how to formulate it. Many of the presentations I've seen here, including yours, the main focus is on what will happen to the individual. What your individual experience will be with the sex technology of the future, or maybe the experience of you and your lover, or you and your small circle of friends. And so, like the last questioner, my interest is more in not what my personal pleasure would be, but what the broader cultural impact would be. And many of the speakers at this conference have sort of given the implication, the unstated implication, that they're confident that as long as the result of the technology, as long as the result of the technology amongst them and their circle of friends is one of more pleasure, that therefore we can confidently infer that the broader cultural implication will be a good one. My experience in the gay male world in San Francisco is that that's a fallacious assumption, and that in fact there are many technologies that give more pleasure that have extremely negative cultural consequences. So I wondered if you could just comment on that. Well, for example, sure. Drugs. For example, internet cruising, which has basically been a catastrophe for the social scene of gay men in San Francisco as everyone stays home and chats online, and bars close and parties end. And
yeah, I mean, technology, the answer is that technology is always dual purpose or triple purpose or quadruple purpose. And so any of the technologies that I'm talking about can absolutely be used in ways that have negative consequences. I don't think that just because an individual gets more pleasure that that automatically translates into a pornotopia. I do have utopian aspirations. I don't think we can get there just by coming a lot. I think that, I know Rich is sad about that. So I think that what you're describing is really a trouble with the broader culture. For example, when you said there's been this the impact of internet cruising on sort of social spaces in gay male communities, I think that that's as much a response to a political climate as it is to the technology itself. I think that the political climate, as it's gotten more conservative, people have retreated more, and there's been a lot of problems with people gathering together to have sex. People who remember Paddlegate in Massachusetts, where people got together for a BDSM party that got busted by the cops. These were parties that had been happening for decades, and it was completely consensual, but they were arrested for assault and battery. So there's these kinds of things happen in our wider culture, and I think that those things drive people into kind of little monads in their homes, hiding away from public gatherings. I don't think we can blame the technology for that. But yeah, I think a lot of these technologies, like, for example, the biosensors, which I'm sort of describing as like, yay, you can have sex as an octopus. You can translate your orgasm into something new. Of course, all those things, if monitored by a hostile government or monitored by a hostile corporation, could be used against you. They could be used to learn what makes you afraid and then control your emotions when you're watching a television show. I mean, all of these things have negative implications. So there's always that battle between the sort of subversive uses, the utopian uses of a technology, and the repressive uses that are made of it. And what I hope is that the more liberatory uses of the technology have a fighting chance of winning out.
Thank you very much, Annalie Newitz.